still coming in for the lecture, and well, we should get going. I'm Nick Caudry, I'm the current head of the Department of Media and Communications at LSC, and my only function right now is to introduce you to the director of LSC, Craig Harvey, who's going to get us started with today's symposium. Thank you very much for coming, Craig.
Well, it's an honor to get invited here. I've just been having conversations with Teria and Nick and Tricia and others about the bittersweet experience of being in a job like mine as director of the LSC. It's very sweet. It's a lovely job. The LSC is fantastic, and I'm enthusiastic about all the work I do. But it's very rare that people treat an administrator like an intellectual. So I would like to express my appreciation and gratitude to Teria and everybody involved in organizing this for inviting me at least to come and say welcome. The nature of being a university administrator, director of the LSC, presidents of the other universities involved in this consortium, is that you spend your time doing a lot of things, raising money, overseeing administrative processes and reviews, worrying about strategy and innovation. Now, does that have to do with the welcome to this conference? Well, you are the reason that's worth doing. It is in order that we can have exciting and even path-breaking intellectual programs and wonderful education for students that there is some point to doing all of this other work. And I want just to say a few words of welcome specifically connected to this program. First, it's my pleasure that I've met both the USC and the LSC sides of this in various ways and have been able to see it from different points of view. And I've also visited in Fudan and be able to see the links from China and in Cape Town. And so I'm able to know all of the institutions at least a little, even if I have this overwhelming loyalty to the LSC as the core. One of the things that I get from that is each institution contributes something distinct. They share a vision of a larger program, but each of the institutional partners in this, USC and LSC from the beginning, had different strengths and recognized it. And this is something that's all too rare and should be commended, to see that the intellectual experience, the educational experience, can be advanced by having different mixtures of orientations. There are national differences, first off, but there are also different balances between more theoretical critical work, between work that is oriented to production and applied work, between work that is focused on the media industries, work that is focused on communication as a problem in social science. There are different perspectives. It happens that the field of global media and communications, perhaps as much as any, is about bringing together different perspectives. And part of the learning, I think, for all students is how to do that, how to be able to connect these things up. A few people have highly specialized careers in this area, but most have careers in which they connect up different aspects. They connect up different parts of the work of communications. And so I think it's appropriate that the degree programs reflect this mix. There's more to it than that. The field is a field that has been in the process of invention, and I hope will stay in the process of invention for a very long time. There is more dynamism in the field of media and communications than in most of our fields. We have terrific scholars in all of our fields, so I'm not denigrating any. But part of the fun of engaging in media and communications and part of the pleasure of choosing a career in it is that it is in what I just called the process of invention. It's not just that it's new. It was new when I was a student, right? When I was a student at USC, the Annenberg School was created. But it's also still new because it's continually reinventing itself. And this is exciting for careers. It's reinventing itself not only in universities, but in, for example, the way in which the social media have transformed lots of communicative practice and work in a variety of different organizations, and a host of other ways. The field of media communications is a work in progress, and that's a good thing. It means you're not mastering some static body of literature and say, I'm just going to apply this for the rest of my life, and I'm going to have a 50-year working life and nothing will change. Well, that's not going to happen. But the fact that your field is changing continuously and adapting means that you're continually ready for new things that are going on in the world. It's not a remedial thing. It's part of what the field does to take account of the new. The field of media and communications, or the fields, since it's really sort of an overlapping thing, have been transformed by the world changing and by their own very concrete engagement with the world. This is sort of the third thing I wanted to say. Media and communications is one of the fields that most lives up to a distinctive virtue of the LSE, which is that it's about the connections between better and better research-based knowledge and actually making a better world. And the porousness, the engagements with the whole world are very strong in media and communications. It never has the temptation, or at least not very often, to be purely academic and insular, nor does it have the idea that being engaged in a career is just a matter of applying what you already learned. It's a matter of continuing to learn because of the very constant change in what's going on, the reorganization of the legacy media that changes whole worlds and changes the practice for people who are in other fields, the rise of new sorts of subfields. Lee Kuliaraki here at LSE is one of the leading people in thinking about humanitarian communications. So this isn't driven by new technology, but it's just as new that there's a whole field of communications practice that is linking the issues of philanthropic fundraising to the work that is being done by NGOs and a variety of organizations around the world in response to crises, emergencies, displacements, wars. This is a continual emergence, reinvention. Well, I won't go on and on with this theme, but in all of these ways, I think there's something very exciting about media and communications as a field, and I hope it's exciting in all the work that you're doing it. But being exciting doesn't mean that it's, and being practically engaged in the world doesn't mean that it's not also a core intellectual field. It is very much a core intellectual field of the social sciences and of wider university contexts. And a bridge, in some cases, from social sciences to the humanities, as for example, historical, even philosophical, literary concerns inform the field of communication studies, to issues of technology, science, technology, and society that are part of the communication studies, but also to all of the social sciences. And at each of our schools, this is part of what's animating about the field. It's a field that is constantly making and remaking connections. And I suspect careers for each of you are going to be doing this as well, so that you're going to be engaged in this. Finally, I want to say, and this is an add-on to what I planned to say, as a couple of us came up in the lift earlier, and we got up here, I almost said elevator. I'm trying to learn to the English. It's a communications thing, but the lift. Somebody stopped me in the corridor and said, what's going on in there? I said, oh, it's the anniversary of a global media and communications program. And he said, yeah, people looked pretty odd in there. Really? Well, you do. In a good way, right? That it is a really global program. This is really not so different from the LSE's programs overall. But it is important to recognize the global character of this particular program. Most of what I've said so far has had to do with media and communications in general. But the global character of this program is particularly suited. Media communications are not just one more thing that has become global. This is one of the key drivers of globalization. Globalization is a product of migrations and movements of people. It's a product of finance and money moving around the world. It's a product of media and communications around the world. And so the way in which we think globally about this is not just a tool, but it's part of the core of what this field is, and being able to understand it globally, to think globally about how we use the knowledge created in media and communications is extremely important for the future of the world. So I'm very glad that this program exists. I'm very grateful to Terry and Patricia who have organized it. I'm grateful to our colleagues who have come from Fudan and UCT and NUS. I actually just arrived from NUS myself last night from Singapore. These colleagues who helped to embody the global character of this field will speak on three key different dimensions of it. So I began by saying I was personally very happy that you honored me by letting me be intellectually enthusiastic rather than just worried about the budget for a little while. But I want to end by saying thank you to the students who are in the room, as well as the teachers, for taking on learning and work that is of constitutive, basic importance for the future of the world. Not just an optional extra, not just a source of a good job, though I hope you all get good jobs, but something that actually makes and shapes the world that we're going to live in for years to come. Thank you for your work in media communications. And now I'm going to do something really embarrassing that is part of my job, and leave and not stay and listen to the wonderful program. I apologize. I have another meeting.
Thank you, Professor Cardin. Is he still in the room? It's my turn. And I have to apologize in advance if I am losing my voice. It's because I have been unwell for a while, and this is the first time I'm speaking publicly in quite some time. And I actually have written something, which is very unusual for me. But first I would, of course, like to say good afternoon and say that it's a great personal and collective pleasure to wish you all welcome to our Global Media Anniversary Seminar. When we started the first global dual master's program with the University of Southern California in 2000, we would never have been able to imagine that 15 years later we would celebrate not only our program with USC, but also our program with Fudan University and our new program with the University of Cape Town. We were not only the first university anywhere in the world to start such a global media program, but now we shall soon become the only university in the world to have three global programs. How come? How did this happen at LSC? There are at least three reasons I can think of, and I'm sure you can think of more. First, LSC from its foundation 120 years ago, has been the most global university in the UK, attracting students from all over the world. For example, many ex-servicemen from the United States came to study at LSC after the First World War. The second reason is the intellectual one. In the 1990s, many academics around the world started using the concept of globalization instead of internationalization, as they were trying to analyze how the world was changing and the role of media and communication in these changes. Many of the leading globalization theorists were working at LSC, including Tony Giddens and Leslie Sclair, who is here today with us. And third, it was up to such individuals as Giddens, as then director of LSC, and Professor Patty Riley, as then director of the Annenberg School of Communication at USC, to put their heads together and invent a new type of master's program in which students would study at two universities in two global cities. Giddens then appointed Roger Silverstone to start the Media and Communication Department at LSC, But before even the department was founded, this program got started. And I was appointed in 1999 to run this program. And Leslie Sclair, again, was teaching one of the first core courses in the program. It was in 2000, as we know now, we started, and Patty and I, we have been working together for the last 15 years. Today, as we celebrate our anniversary, we also celebrate institutions, ideas, and individuals, but above all, our former and present students. Today, we have over 600 global alumni working around the world. They do amazing things, and their professional roles, they practice every form of communication. When the globalization debate started in the 1990s, it was very much about whether we actually needed a new concept and whether nation states were losing their power as a result of globalization. Today, we sadly must acknowledge that the days of happy globalization that the first theorist envisaged are probably over, and globalization is now often seen in darker colors. But there is no doubt that globalization is here to stay, even if many of us now use other concepts in our research. All contemporary phenomena, from disasters, epidemics, and climate change, to financial crises, refugee crises, and terrorist attacks, have shown us that our world can no longer be neatly divided into the international and the national. As a result, we need to recognize the multiplicity of layers and actors to understand these processes. And we need to understand that global media and communication not only unite people, but also distanciate them from one another. Despite all the new technology and network that connect us, the contents of media and communication also create barriers and boundaries that continue to divide people, no matter how much time-space compression there is. These challenging times also test the theories that we use to analyze our rapidly changing world. One of the issues we need to address is how to do comparative research. If our interests go beyond, as they should, what has traditionally been called the West, what kind of lenses do we need through which we do our research? Do we just carry on as we have done in the past, dividing the world into countries or into the West and the rest? And carry on with our comparisons based on our existing theories and methodologies. But if we acknowledge that old divisions no longer necessarily hold, how much sense does it make to carry on doing research using container models such as countries and the division between the West and the East? What is it that separates or unites people and their use of media and communications nowadays? Their nationality, their ethnicity, religion, or that they are Western or non-Western? This is the topic Dr. Schoen will address in her talk. As the world becomes more complex and new boundaries are being erected, the need for dual programs, such as ours, with our existing and future partner universities, becomes even greater. We need specialists who understand the sensitive nature of global media and communications and how these can be used to include rather than to exclude people. We need specialists who in their work take into account the diversity of their audiences and users. We need specialists who see the world as it is, in all its complexities and contradictions, but are not afraid to try to overcome these. We need specialists who acknowledge the proper degree of intimacy and proper distance, as Roger Silverstone called it. But how do we educate our students? Can we provide our students with the analytical skills they actually need in their professional lives? Our alumni panel will tackle these and other questions later in the afternoon. So enough opening words, and I'm about to lose my voice. It's time to start our debates in a true LSC manner. What could be a better place than the Shaw Library, one of the few places at LSC named after a woman, Charlotte Shaw? Our advancement office asked me to remind you that you can also make your mark by donating money to LSC, as many of you have already done by buying a ticket for a current student to attend our anniversary dinner later today, and we are very grateful for that. But now it's time for Dr. Ping Chung Meng to introduce our next keynote speaker, Dr. Rakachan. Thank you.
Dr. Shum is currently based in National University of Singapore as a senior visiting scholar. Before that, she taught at Arizona State University and our Department of Media Communication here at LSC. So on a personal level, it's also a great pleasure to see her here at this occasion. Dr. Shum writes on post-colonial cultures, transnational feminism, and media communication cultures. Her current research interests are in Asian modernities, transnational relations of India, racism and media in a global context, transnational media cultures and gender, and the transnational politics of knowledge production as a communication issue. Dr. Shum has published numerous articles and books, book chapters in leading journals and anthologies in the field of media communication studies. Many of her works that some of my colleagues and I are still using in our teaching. Her most recent book entitled Diana and Beyond, White Femininity, National Identity, and Contemporary Media Culture is a book that examines how new sets of post-colonial relations in contemporary Western cultures are mediated through images of white femininity. Under her co-guest editorship, the first ever special issue on post-colonialism was published in the field of communication studies in the International Communication Association journal, Communication Theory, in 2002. She recently also guest edited a special issue on Asian modernities in the journal Global Media and Communication, which included several articles focused on the question of what it means to be modern outside of liberal Western frameworks. She's finishing up another special issue as guest editor for Cultural Studies Critical Methodologies Journal, Gender, Nation, Colonialism, 21st Century Connections. I could go on, but I suspect you'll probably rather hearing from Dr. Rakachan herself. And the title for her talk today is Critical Reflections on quote-unquote de-Westernizing Media and Communication Studies. Dr. Shum.
Thank you, Bing Chung, for that generous and wonderful introduction. So I want to begin by first congratulating the Global Media Program for successfully completing 15 years, and it's quite an achievement, as Terry documented just now. And so it's a tremendous honor for me to participate in this celebration. And I want to thank the Global Media Program and especially Professor Terry Rantanen for inviting me to deliver this address. I think we all know that under Terry's leadership, as well as Pat Riley's fantastic leadership, aided by Professor Bing Chung Meng, this Global Media Program has become one of the most visible programs of the kind in our field. So really, huge congratulations. My goal today in this talk is to critically reflect on and indeed trouble a particular research impetus that has informed communication and media studies in recent years under the rubric of globalizing communication. This is the impetus of de-Westernizing media or communication studies. My reflections join some recent debates that have been occurring in our field about de-Westernizing, seen, for instance, in a recent 2012 issue of Media, Culture, and Society, or even a more recent special issue in the journal Communication Theory, or even the recent edited collection by Georgia Twine, just to name a few. Given that the desire to de-Westernize or internationalize, terms that are often interchangeably used, seems to be occurring in many fields in the humanities and social sciences, my remarks can also be seen as speaking to the larger move of de-Westernizing academic knowledge that is being argued for in many disciplines in the Western academy, especially today. I should say that although the context of today's celebration is global media studies, my remarks, however, will not simply focus on media, but raise larger theoretical problematics about de-Westernization itself. Further, throughout my talk, I place the terms de-Westernization or internationalization within scare quotes because of my discomfort with their conceptual and analytical potential, in relation to which I will be arguing for a transnational approach. I should say at the outset that I do not dismiss or diminish the important work that has been done under the rubric of de-Westernization in our field. They are in some ways certainly useful starting points for the kinds of conversations we are able to have, as in this forum. Rather, I'm interested in reflecting on how de-Westernization, as a trope, as a logic, and as desire, can often be more limiting than productive, unless it is linked to issues of decolonization of knowledge. Throughout this talk, I will suggest in various ways that the need of the day is perhaps less de-Westernization and more decolonization of knowledge, especially in what gets called the Western Academy. In communication and media studies, the term de-Westernization, or some version of it, as a mode of engaging in global communication or international communication, notions that are often, very superficially substituted for each other, has seen significant usage in many recent texts, beginning more formally, perhaps from the 2000 Curran and Park edited volume. Such moves emanate from the much-needed recognition of the parochialism and Euro-US centrism that has generally plagued not just media studies, but the communication discipline at large. Such moves of de-Westernization that have occurred and are occurring in our field, as I mentioned, exist from the much-needed recognition of the US Eurocentrism and parochialism. Now, while appreciating the underlying benevolent impetus of de-Westernization that many such texts evince, I want to suggest, however, that de-Westernization is a politics without guarantees, to use Stuart Hall's admittedly overused phrase. There is no necessary guarantee that de-Westernization will result in de-Euro or de-US centrism of our research imaginations, to use Apadurai's term. What we need is not just de-Westernization, but a decolonization of our frameworks and research imaginations. This means recognizing that our research frameworks are inevitably linked to questions of power, history, and geopolitics. It means recognizing that colonial legacies and post-colonial inequalities continue to inform academic cultures, especially North Atlantic and largely Western academic cultures, enabling particular ways of producing, recognizing, circulating, and disciplining knowledge, knowledge practices, notions of what counts as knowledge, and the attitudes and histories through which we as scholars approach and continue to produce knowledge. As scholars, we are all historically situated subjects, unequally positioned in global relations of power, which certainly has implications, as feminist and postcolonial scholarship have powerfully noted, for how we approach or not any topic, especially one as complex as de-Westernization. Complex because the matter of de-Westernization inevitably poses the problematic of self and other, problematic within which we as scholars, teachers, and intellectuals are implicated. Often calls for de-Westernization, while well-intentioned, shore up a pluralist, additive, liberal logic of international diversity. A we are the world flavor that can endlessly seek global difference, but occludes the larger issue of colonial and geopolitical power relations that have, in the first place, produced the very difference we seek as difference. The work of radical sinologist Takeuchi Yoshimi, writing in the 1960s and the 1970s, for instance, argued in his groundbreaking book, What is Modernity?, that the idea of Asia itself was a product of a Western construction of Asia as inferior, that the idea of Asia as a negation, as Asians being inferior or not modern, itself came upon with the invasion of Western powers and the establishment of capitalism and modernization. Frequently, de-Westernizing moves fall short of recognizing that the here and the there, the global north and the global south, are intimately, violently, and unequally linked in global relations of power and the underlying colonial histories that inform them. Contemporary Britain has been built upon through the spoils and exploits of colonialism, within which those of us in the UK and in UK institutions are certainly implicated. Calls for de-Westernization also do not typically foreground how unequal racial privileges, and there is a lot of work done in critical race studies on white privilege in the academy, shape us as scholars, although they do not necessarily determine us, and the kinds of research imaginations, intellectual and social relations we reinforce, reproduce, or bring about in our academic cultures that have implications for the kind of spaces we create for intellectual habitation. If de-Westernization is to be a subversive critical practice, that is subversive of the dominance of Western and today increasingly North Atlantic power structures in knowledge production and distribution, if it is to be a practice that seeks to recognize the relation between knowledge, history, and geopolitics, then we need to move beyond a shallow, safe, and sanitized notion of de-Westernization as only being a matter of diversifying our research frameworks by adding global perspectives. Benign apolitical internationalism, or what Koichi Iwabuchi has termed banal internationalism, or what I call additive internationalism, where we simply add knowledge about other societies deemed as non-Western or different to our frameworks in a kind of lateral spatial movement, instead of descending into the depths of the histories on geopolitics to inquire what makes possible the existence and dominance of certain knowledge structures and not others does not do much in decolonizing knowledge structures. So why is this important, obvious as this question might be? Because it is precisely the histories of colonialism that have today brought us to a moment where we now have a gross and violent imbalance in global knowledge structures, academic and everyday. What eminent historian Dipesh Chakraborty has termed asymmetric ignorance, unquote, that results in the need for some kind of de-Westernization in the first place that is being argued for in many disciplines in the academy. Ironically, a banal or additive internationalism can quite easily connect to global difference today, for under global capitalism, difference itself is highly visible as it is marketed increasingly as commodity, sought after by global corporations as they seek newer markets and newer workforces in cultures and societies that hitherto escaped our structures of recognition, globally dominant structures of recognition. Indeed, as I have argued along with my co-author in a 2002 article in Critical Studies in Media Communication, that globalization ironically cannot function without cultural difference. But what is increasingly difficult to connect to today is alterity, as opposed to just difference, a radical and subversive alterity that becomes more and more distant from us under the rationalities of neoliberalism that make visible and recognizable certain contexts of global difference, but make it difficult or even impossible to connect to knowledge formations, imaginations, contexts, vocabularies, and bodies that have either been refused recognition historically in global machines of knowledge production, or that have been so other that it is a struggle even to access them, and hence the limits of representation itself. As anthropologist Rosalind Morris notes in her discussion of feminist Gayatri Spivak's notion of radical alterity, that to attempt to engage radical alterity as opposed to just visible difference is to be reminded of the, and I quote Morris, the ungraspable otherness that remains beyond our reach, and that also constitutes who we are, the otherness in relation to which we are both indebted and unable to know the full extent of our accountability, unquote. All this clearly leads to an important question: what should be the stakes in our de-Westernizing impulses as we attempt to globalize communication? Is the goal simply to foster a we are the world flavor? Is it simply to encourage cultural multiplicities in our frameworks? Or is it and should be to redress and challenge the colonial logics that have left their traces in our research practices and our academic relations, and that results in continuing violent global imbalance in knowledge production? Indeed, where do we want our de-Westernizing impulses to go? And I think that's a crucial question. What do we want them to do? I mean, it's one thing to say, let's de-Westernize, but where do we want them to go? And it becomes an ethical question. And to me, it's a transnationally situated ethical question. And who is the we? What are the fractures in that we? How is that we itself transnationally and historically articulated and situated? Indeed, what should be the ethics of our so-called de-Westernizing impulses? How we frame the matter of de-Westernization as a challenge to the problem of Euro or US centrism in our field depends much on how we conceive of the problem of Eurocentrism in knowledge structures, in the academy, in the first place. And I am not sure that there has been a sustained and deep discussion of the dynamics of US Eurocentrism in our field. As media sociologist Silvio Voice Board recently asked, and I quote, "On whose terms is de-Westernization conducted?" Unquote. If de-Westernization is one logic through which the intellectual imperatives of our field is being performed, let us not forget that during colonial times and even today, many colonized populations did not have the luxury to refuse internationalization. They were already violently articulated by many of the available structures of internationalization, including of Western education, which for them was an international interaction, that colonialisms coerced them into as part of a larger narrative of civilizing natives. Indeed, we cannot forget the lessons provided by the Algerian revolutionary psychiatrist and anti-colonial activist Frantz Fanon in Black Skin, White Masks, where he so powerfully noted how the struggle for recognition from the Antillean resulted in a coercive desire on the part of the colonized to learn the language, education, and the ways of French culture itself, resulting in the psychological trauma of the colonized. These complex issues require also some kind of a provisional starting point for a discussion of what we mean by the West. Thus far, most of the moves towards topical and methodological de-Westernization implicitly or explicitly signify the West, and thus, you know, by implication, the non-West, as a cartographic index, to use Naoki Sakai's term. That is, the West is seen in terms of geography. But where does the West end and the non-West or the rest or the non-West begin, as Terry's remarks were also suggesting? As post-colonial scholarship has so powerfully reminded us over the last 30 years or so, what we territorially and even culturally consider to be the territorial borders of the West itself is an outcome of the various modernizing imperatives of colonialism that continue even today. But the term West is still around in everyday and academic culture, and therefore we cannot jettison it so easily just saying I don't like it. Even though, as Sakai rightly notes, its analytical purchase is declining in a world where the here and the there are violently and intimately connected. So what is the West? How should we conceive of the West? I want to suggest that the West needs to be primarily understood as a power structure and less a matter of cartography. The West is and has been a racial, colonial, and capitalist power structure that is today reviving itself again through logics of culturalism and exceptionalism that are showed up by the violent militarization of many of its societies, seen simply, for instance, in the recent case of and reaction to Syrian refugees and the representations in the media. The revived hatred towards Muslims after the Paris bombing, which we know has rendered invisible the aftermath of the Beirut bombings. We simply don't know what's happening, what's the aftermath of Beirut. And that is foregrounding Paris once again as a seeming cultural capital of civilization. Naoki Sakai writes, and I quote Sakai, "The notion of the West cannot be cleansed of its racist implications as long as culturalism is a most prevalent means of naturalizing and essentializing a person's social identity," unquote. Thus, Sakai asks, and I quote him again, "Can we continue to overlook the fact that the distinction between the West and the rest is increasingly independent of race, ethnic, culture, or nationality?" Unquote. Further, in the geographies that we call the West, there are populations that are constantly violated racially and in other ways. Working class immigrants, disempowered post-colonial populations, who to that extent might territorially be in the West, but they are not, you know, within the power structures of the West in any kind of an equitable way. Their diasporic subjectivities may sometimes be expressed through media forms such as street art, graffiti, body tattooing, and even something like the veil, the burqa and the niqab, that we rarely think of as a media object or a media form. The so-called West or the non-West exists within the West or the global global North. As Terry suggested, we must exit a spatially bounded research framework where we see the so-called non-West only in geographies far away that we label as the West. Refugees, the imagined figure of the terrorist, the Muslim, the asylum seeker, the low-skilled migrant worker, the migrant caregiver, the globally trafficked sex worker who ends up in many metropolitan centers of the West might be in the territory called the West, but they are not usually able to be Western when we understand Western in terms of a power structure. As I speak here today, young black bodies in the US are being targeted by an increasingly militarized police force and a heightened law and order society that increasingly views imprisonment and not rehabilitation as public good. This is a society where, for many blacks, the nation, as Henri Giroux recently noted, feels once again like a jail, a zone of abandonment. After so many decades since the civil rights movement, one is having to assert once again that black lives matter. These black lives, too, are not Western in terms of power structures, as their bodies are violated by a resurgence of nationalism and overt expressions of xenophobic whiteness in contemporary US. Such violence towards black bodies, seen as unruly or frightening, cannot be separated from the larger militarization of everyday life that has been occurring in the US since 9/11, where being suspicious of bodies that do not look like us is becoming an important civic responsibility of the citizen, and where the notion of a suspicious body keeps changing as geopolitical contexts shift and reframe themselves. Indeed, if we are to engage in a transnationally and racially reflexive de-Westernization, for the issue of race, as I have argued, cannot be separated from a politics of de-Westernization, then we need to be looking not just outwards to some territory or place we mark as a non-West, but also, quote-unquote, within the sites that we cartographically designate as the West. Relatedly, it is important to note that while the West is too often framed through a cartographic logic, the issue of the West as temporality, time, minimally figures in our discussions. The time of the West, and particularly today the North Atlantic West, has been framed in history through a logic of linearity, which is also a logic of progress, or what Deepesh Chakraborty has called a stagist view of history. We are moving forward, always progressing, the linearity of progress. Such a logic of temporality itself functioned to stage others, non-Westerners, the colonized, as what Chakraborty calls a not yet, i.e. not yet modern, and thus placed in another time, that is always behind, always in deferral, yet always haunting and taunting the temporal structures of the West. Thus, what it meant to be Western or means to be Western is also a temporal matter. The linear logic of temporality informing Western structures of power, including today, deny or render invisible the multiple temporalities that reside within the so-called West, unsettling its claim to progress. Media and technology scholar Sarah Sharma's recent and really excellent work has shown, for instance, how taxi drivers in New York, and she considers the taxi as media, due to their working conditions, the politics of their labor, and the times in which they work, literally clock time in which they work, inhabit a very different and abused temporality than the speediness of the technologized jet-set traveler in New York taxis. The taxi driver lives in the margins of temporality in a seemingly speedy place called New York. And to be noted, of course, is that taxi cab drivers in New York are mainly from Africa or Bangladesh. The politics of de-Westernization, or decolonization, as is my preference, must thus also be connected to a politics of time, of a politics over time, indeed, a politics of modernities itself. The other point I want to make, echoing some scholars who have also reinforced this, is that there is no homogeneous West. And I know we've heard this, not as much as we should in our field, but I consider it so important that I did want to reinforce it in my talk today. And we, including scholars from Asia or Africa, need to resist the desire to argue for notions such as, and I pick these phrases because I see them a lot, notions such as Asian media studies, or Asian communication theories, or African communication studies, and so on. Reactionary theory building in an effort to avoid the West is at best unproductive. A nativist attitude to our research is dangerous for the times in which we live. I would say nativist as well as regionalist, and there's a lot of talk these days about regionalism. There can be media studies of Asia or media studies of Africa, but not an Asian media studies or an African media studies, as though there is some internal coherence to the notion Asia or Africa. In a recently published book, Asia as a Method, communication and cultural studies scholar Wan Hing Cheng argues that, and I quote Chen, rather than being constantly anxious about the question of the West, we, and he means scholars in and from Asia, we can actively acknowledge it as part of our formation of our subjectivity. In the form of fragmented pieces, the West has entered our history and become part of it, but not in a totalizing manner. The task for Asia as a method, he's deliberately talking of Asia as a method, reworking Takeuchi Yoshimi's writings. The task of Asia as a method is to multiply frames of reference in our subjectivity so the constant anxiety over the West can be diluted, but not erased, I guess. I know I'm a little short on time, so I'm going to quickly move to the other part of my talk, that is discussing the limits of comparative research. And there is just so much to say here that by necessity, I've had to keep it very short and not be able to go into the depths that I would like, but perhaps the Q&A session would allow some discussion. What I suggest is that while in some ways comparative research as a methodological framework may be useful in challenging universalisms in our theories and methodologies, their limits, at least to me, are perhaps more unproductive and outweigh their benefits. Instead of a comparative perspective, I want to suggest that we move towards a framework that sees media and communication contexts and cultures as transnationally linked, which is very different from the concept of international, by unequal relations and flows of power, and that we adopt a transnational relational approach in which our understanding of context A and B would require us to examine the transnational power relations that link A and B in particular ways, but often in shifting ways. They are never static. Such a move then moves us more easily into a practice of decolonization. Clearly, I am not the first to advocate this. Influential transnational feminist scholars, such as Inderpal Garwal, Karen Kaplan, Chandra Mohanty, and some others, suggested this well over 15 years ago when they were forging the theoretical contours of what we now today, you know, we designate the area called transnational feminist studies. Such an approach would also foreground the realities of our times that unequally connect or disconnect subjects, contexts, histories, and geographies within which media cultures circulate and that are also informed by unequal media flows. So instead of just noting that the Paris attack received much more attention in media than the Beirut attack, the issue here would be to note how theorizing how larger geopolitical and colonial legacies articulate and connect these sites in unequal ways that have showed up, in this instant at least, as I suggested earlier, a violent civilizational logic, and really a very fearful logic, whose effects are just being felt as terror itself is being regulated and framed to produce new and possibly dangerous modes of governmentality. And one thinks here of Donald Trump, and I know that none of us love Donald Trump, but he has the space to influence mindsets. One thinks of Donald Trump saying that under his leadership, there would be databases for every Muslim in the US. And Paris, a city of romance and love, Paris is supposed to be beautiful, but depends on who you are, is beginning to look like a fearful war zone. Thus, I find it more useful to examine unequal transnational and historical linkages of power to understand why things are what they are, instead of simply a comparative framework where the issue of relationality is too often obscure. As Gayatri Spivak noted, and I quote Spivak, "Comparison assumes a level playing field, but the field is never level, if only in terms of the interest implicit in the perspective. It is, in other words, never a question of compare and contrast, but rather a matter of judging and choosing. And when the playing fields are not even continuous, the problem of comparativism becomes immense," unquote. Similarly, R. Radhakrishnan and even Walter Mignolo, the subaltern studies Latin American scholar, who in a book that recently came out, which to me in 2013, one of the most exciting books on comparative research, edited by Susan Stanford Friedman and Rita Felsky. Similarly, Radhakrishnan, in this recent edited collection, has pointed to the problem of research engaging in comparisons. The researcher is not neutral. We know this is not a new point I'm making, even though in social sciences we too often forget that. And the notion of the researcher as a detached observer is still valued. But the researcher is a historically situated subject. So who is initiating the comparison? Or as Radhakrishnan asks, and I quote, "Who is officially responsible for the comparison, self or other, or both?" Unquote. Indeed, the comparative researcher cannot be objective, for the researcher is already situated within a tradition of scholarship from which, whether they are aware or not, we engage in comparison. Thus, the issue of self-reflexivity, a political and ethical self-reflexivity, is already embedded in the problem of comparison, whether we choose to confront it or not. Now, two other quick points, and I know I will really be quick because I also want to hear Wendy's remarks. Two other quick points. One is the issue of borders. In our times of continuous migrations, most live their lives at borders, not just territorial borders, but cultural borders, psychic borders, emotional borders. It has been well established now in diaspora studies that border lives, migrations, and diasporic contexts are emblematic of our times. Yet, because a comparative framework must at least consider two or more somewhat stable entities, you know, even if it's a constructed stability that we bring to it, marked by some boundaries that it seeks to compare, it cannot, as Walter Mignolo so recently in the book that I mentioned forcefully notes, address the issue of borders, and yet most of us live our lives in constantly shifting borders. So as geopolitical context and contours change, borders proliferate, shift, and mutate. They disappear and sometimes reappear in a new guise. Yet, the underlying premises of comparative thinking require some independence of the entities being compared, and thus makes the engagement with borders, borderlines, border imaginations, bordered mediation, you know, to come back to our discipline, virtually impossible to deal with. A final point I wish to make is the need for going south, south-to-south connections. We need more scholarship on south-to-south connections in global communication studies, including south-to-south media flows. There has been very little work in our field, as well as in transnational studies at large, that addresses transnational linkages of societies and their flows through the numerous vectors of the global south. For instance, where Bollywood media culture is concerned, most of the work, and I'm also guilty of this, focuses on Bollywood from India to the West flow, primarily because it's accessible to study these flows. Yet Bollywood culture has a complex and unequal transnational and historical relationality with Nigeria, as Brian Larkin's work has noted. Or consider again how under the Taliban dominance in Afghanistan until the early 2000s, a vibrant but underground Bollywood video culture existed. Or that today in Afghanistan, Bollywood fashion, the fashion of Bollywood stars, is followed by the youth in their attempts to assert new forms of agency and individuality. But what enables these flows? What power relations are served by them? We cannot separate these issues, especially this latter issue of Bollywood flows in Afghanistan today, from a larger developmental and a rather conservative rhetoric of incredible India and its dominance and will to power that has been occurring and that is being reinforced by the current right-wing Prime Minister Narendra Modi. We cannot separate this unequal media flows, where Bollywood flows into Afghanistan, a Muslim-dominated space, where most are Muslims, while Muslims today in India, under right-wing Prime Minister Modi, and the growing Hindutva, that is Hindu fundamentalism, live under fear as they receive messages all around in their surroundings that they do not belong to India. Nor can we separate these issues from a larger history of British colonialism in India, when at the end, as the nation was divided along the cultural lines of Muslims and Hindus, resulting in contemporary Pakistan and India, it has forever ignited mutual suspicion and mistrust between Hindus and Muslims in India. In such a scenario, multiple and intersecting layers of power connect. Psychologies and emotional lives collide and collude. Past and present, histories and geographies remain entangled with each other. And geopolitics and local politics collide and collude. So what I have discussed so far really has relevance for the broader area in our field that at least institutionally gets labeled global communication studies. So let me just end by saying that ultimately to me, global communication studies or globalizing media studies, whatever phrase we want to use, is and must be a political project. Because, to quote Stuart Hall, you have to take a position in relation to it, which does not mean, of course, that you have to tell yourself lies about it or fake it, but you have to invest in the position. It has to matter to you which story comes out. It has to matter to you which story you're able to tell yourself, which stories you can live by, which fictions you can bear, and which you cannot bear. Thank you.
very much, Rebecca, for such a provocative lecture that I've enjoyed tremendously, and it has given me a lot of thoughts that I probably will not be able to elaborate on in this response. So, and thanks also very much to Terry for inviting me to respond to Raqqa, which is a great honour, although at the same time also a great challenge, because I've been following Raqqa's work for some time. I think we first met in 2006 at the Crossroads Cultural Studies Conference.
Right.
I found it really inspiring for my own work. So this means also that I find it very difficult to disagree with her arguments. So today's response is very much a friendly attempt to raise a few critical questions. And of course, I also would like to express my thanks to all of you for being here. It's great to see so many of you here and to be able to celebrate the anniversary of this program, and also to witness the birth of a new program, the program with the University of Cape Town. And also I'd like to welcome Herman Wassermann from the University of Cape Town, who was very lucky to be here today. I have desperately tried to shorten my remarks while Raqqa was talking. No, that's absolutely fine. So I will probably go through my questions quite quickly. So the first question that very much comes to mind is why is comparative research important? And I think Raqqa has given an answer to that, which I very much agree with as well. In my view, a key aim of comparative research should be to enable us to gain not only a better understanding of different parts of the world, but also to create a more just system of academic knowledge production that is more willing to reflect on the different vantage points from where knowledge is being produced. And comparative approaches should not be about adding a little bit of colour to global media studies, but should help us to challenge the universality that's often assumed in Eurocentric approaches. However, of course, there are a number of key constraints to this project. And as Raqqa has already mentioned, and as I've also pointed out in some of my work, there are structural barriers and fundamental inequalities which shape the nature of global academic knowledge production. And perhaps we could also debate to what extent it is possible to create change within the space of our current universities, which have been in flux in the last 2 decades. In the last year, however, we've seen a number of inspiring student initiatives aimed at transforming universities into more inclusive spaces. This year, 2015, started with a major student campaign known as Roads Must Fall at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. And it started out as protest against the statue of Cecil John Rhodes, a British colonialist, on university premises, but were also linked to broader calls for the need for faculty transformation, racial transformation, and Africanization and decolonization of university curricula. At the same time, in the UK, we have seen a student campaign known as Why Is My Curriculum White, led by faculty and students at University College London, and later also adopted by students at other universities, including the LSE. And the key message of this campaign was the need to diversify the scholars listed on university curricula and reading lists, which so far are privileging the perspectives of white male scholars. Another campaign was around the struggle for a university of colour, which was a project at the University of Amsterdam earlier this year, and which emerged in the context of the protests around the Nieuwe Universiteit, the new university that took place again earlier this year. And in the last few weeks, we have seen student protests emerging in the US at the University of Missouri and Yale University, pointing to racial discrimination and the need for safe spaces for students of colour. So one of my questions to Raqqa, which is perhaps a strategic question, is whether we are able to achieve change within the current university spaces, and how do we go about it? How can we make productive links with student struggles that are perhaps in many ways ahead of us, academics? Or is the university by nature a space that is all about the reproduction of a range of privileges? And should we concentrate our efforts on spaces outside the university? How do we create what, perhaps in response to Raqqa, I could call constitutive internationalism instead of additive internationalism? And secondly, why do we need to compare, and why is this a project worth pursuing? arguably, yeah, this, as Raka also already alluded to, for those in the global south, research has always been comparative, but involuntarily so. Many universities in the global south emerged as part of the process of colonialism. And for a decolonial scholar, Ramon Gross Fuguel, the university globally is by nature a westernized university. And he argues that curricula globally do not really differ in major ways. We see the same number of scholars emerging on these curricula, whether it's in South Korea, whether it's in Burkina Faso, or in Mexico. So do we all need to aspire to produce global or transnational knowledge, given this longer history of knowledge production? Should we instead produce knowledge that ties in with local research agendas? What is really the importance of global knowledge? And what is the role of local knowledge in this regard? And finally, where do the comparative and the need for decolonization intersect? What values do concepts such as the global north and the global south still have? And do these categories still have value in a world in which inequality is increasingly more equally distributed? So what would comparative research mean in the context of decolonization? And these are the questions that I wanted to raise. Thank you very much.
So Wendy, thank you so much for those certainly extremely important and urgent questions for our times. Because we want to keep some time for discussion, I of course can't respond to all of that, but I will respond try to the one that really stuck with me is the issue of how to engage in all this stuff at an institutional level. That's the challenge that we all face. There is no easy answer, but there are things that incrementally can be done, because I have, with age and hopefully more wisdom, I have now begun to believe in a politics of patience. You know, it's like when you were a graduate student, you went into an undergraduate classroom and you thought, as long as I just tell them, why can't they see it my way? But it's things that we do at a pedagogical level, the kind of leadership that we bring about, you know, who's going to lead a department, what kind of a scholar, who's at the larger administrative levels of our institutions, the kind of working groups that we have. They seem kind of, I know what I'm saying seems rather bland, but I think that the kind of questions that through our own readings we are able to ask of our departmental institutional cultures begins to drive dents, you know, into the way in which knowledge begins, hopefully, begins to kind of get loosened. The fact that we are standing here today able to have this discussion is important, because 20 years back, maybe in the LSE department, I don't know, maybe that was not possible. The department didn't exist then, I forgot about. So one of Wendy's questions, I think, was that, do we do this work outside of the institution or just inside the institution? I generally resist the distinction between institution and the outside world. I think we are all informed by the outside world. So who's outside, who's inside? Wendy, that's a little, that makes me a little nervous. Our students are inside and outside. So let me just say quickly, issues of pedagogy, what we are teaching students. Content is very important. And not just content of people who we know, even though they might be in quote-unquote other worlds, but work that makes us very uncomfortable, I think, is important. The kind of intellectual imaginations that we are able to bring about at a departmental and institutional level, and as I said, administrative changes are very important. So I will mention these two, knowing this is not a perfect answer, because there is no quick solution. Global exchange programs like the one that Terry and Pat's program leadership has instituted, I think, are also important, because even though it may not be result in a deep engagement with otherness, but there is some engagement with otherness that gets you know, that it can accommodate. So all kinds of institutional building, practice building becomes important, and there is, as I said, no one solution, and I don't have a perfect answer. We are all good at raising questions.
Okay, I think I'm going to use my power as the chair to decide. I'm going to shorten the break between this one and the next panel for 5 minutes so that we can still have 10 minutes for question and answer. Yes, please.
I wouldn't consider myself a media scholar. I share Wendy's enthusiasm. I'm not a media scholar, although as a sociologist, I find media scholars indispensable. And I share Wendy's enthusiasm for the general tenor of Bracco's, if I may, talk. And maybe I'm just getting cynical in my way, but there's too little of that sort of talk around LSD over the past few years in my view. The only thing that I found missing in Bracco's talk was the extraordinarily rich literature around Orientalism, not just Edward Said's original book, but the huge response it elicited. Now, I don't know the literature on de-Westernization in media studies, so either that literature ignores it. I'm sure you're very aware of it, and not just that, but also the whole post-colonial debate. You did mention in passing the subaltern literature. But it seems to me that the debate around Orientalism would be really useful in interrogating many of the unanswerable questions that you presented to us. So that's... can I also just add one very short question? And that is, I think it's important to distinguish between global knowledge and knowledge of the global.
Yes.
But I'll leave that to someone else.
Do we have more questions? I think we can maybe take them as a cluster given the limited time we have left, and then Raka can give a response to some of them. Yes, Tom.
Yeah, my question is really just a simple one. Why is it necessarily bad to have a predominantly Western body of thought represented at a Western institution of higher education?
What was the question? Why is it what?
Western. Sorry, can you repeat the first half? Why is it so bad to have a dominance of...
A Western sort of body of scholars represented at a Western institution of higher education.
Why are there so bad to have a
Western body of knowledge or body of scholars?
Western body of scholars being represented in a Western institution.
Read Edward Said and Orientalism.
Well, I take your question seriously. Thank you for that. The issue, I think, at one level is not to essentialize a Western body, but that our bodies, as feminist scholarship, if you've dabbled in it, would know that our bodies are already historical bodies. You know, they have shaped us in particular ways, and therefore they inform our research imaginations. So to me, the more important question is not whether there are more Western bodies or not, but what are these bodies doing? What scholarship are they producing? You know, because there is a fine balance between arguing for more non-Western, quote-unquote, bodies in our academic spaces and essentialism. But at a more simple level, let me just say, why is it bad? Because it just reproduces colonial imaginations. It has the potential possibility to do that. Our academic structures are very white. We can walk into any Western institutions in the West and see how the professoriate is very white. So I see that as a problem. If you don't, then I think I would invite you to read up a little bit more and consider how that could be a problem. Thank you for that.
I'm not an academic, but I was a journalist, and I've been a journalist in very many countries. I'm also a very strong community activist in a small place, but we connect with people locally. And I'd like to know, and I'm longing for more from the East and from the South, because I think we are at such a pitch in our economics now. It's that basic things that human beings need are becoming dysfunctional. They're dysfunctional here, as well as they are dysfunctional elsewhere. And I think there's a commonality there that could be addressed. But I would be interested to know how you feel there's no difference between the outside and the student world. Well, there is. You know, there's a lot of people who can't be students. Mm-hmm. They can't afford it. And there's a lot to, I don't know, it's a very special world, this, and this is a wonderful place. I'm really learning about the program. I think it's great. I think it's a brilliant initiative, and I would like to know what you would do for activism, for connecting people, because we need new outlets. We definitely do. And I'm finding in my local community that we are discovering new journalists, new outlets, they go across the world.
Okay, we'll take... Do you want to respond?
I thought that was more a comment than you're saying.
Okay. Should we take another, I think probably final question?
I really liked the solemn question because it was related to what I was thinking. Like many times I hear like global South thinkers, professors, and they are always relating to the West like an obsession. And many times I feel like it's like the Westerns, that they should be de-Westernized in some sense. Because it's like the historical constructions, like we are the inheritance of the civilization of the world, something like that. And this is not like historically actually, like if you see the West, it was like the barbarians from the Greek, they were much more related to the Russian. So, in many other sense. And sometimes I feel it's like a lack of courage of not like using Western thinkers, but I think it's something related to the hierarchy of the academia, and it's like very muted in the academia frame, that you also have to relate to the superior, to the stronger knowledge, something like that. I just want to make this provocation that why de-Westernized people are so obsessive with the West, and I cannot even understand sometimes what the West is when we are talking about.
So I think your question, the last part of your comment that you can't understand what the West is well taken, because that's one of the challenges that we have now. As geopolitical contexts constantly change, where is the West is important. And so this is more an important question you raised. But I think the other part of your comment, if I understood it, was people from the so-called non-West being obsessed about the West. Is that...
Yes, to relate to itself. Why... like India, Bollywood, in terms of bibliography, in terms of representations, in terms of mythology, hierarchies, like why it's so difficult to get in touch with other cultures, academically speaking, without crossing to the West academia. Like, this is something important. It's not necessarily bad, not necessarily good, but there is a relevance, I think, in this, because the narrative is always constructed in the same way.
If I'm understanding your comment correctly, my one response is that as the Inter-Asia, the very important Inter-Asia Culture Studies Network has pointed out, that for people in the so-called non-West, because the structures of colonialism decimated
their ability to produce knowledge. There is very little like own knowledge. You know, I know far less about China than I do about others. So as the quote that I used in my talk, the West is very much a part of our subjectivity. So that is not a problem in and of itself. It is what you do with the recognition, you know, that the West has formed you. So what you are perhaps suggesting obsession with the West, it's less an obsession, it's your everyday formation. How are you going to unsettle that without recognizing that you cannot go back to, not that there ever was, but you can't go back to your pure space. You know, there can't be like Bollywood representations that somehow look for a real India because it doesn't exist. Right? So your question, whether you realize it or not, already invokes the need for multiple layers of histories, geographies, connections to be addressed, and disconnections. Maybe, I don't know if that answered your question.
Okay, I think we have to finish now, and we will take a 10-minute break and then we'll recongregate at 4:45 for the alumni panel. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'm Patty Riley. I'm from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication, which founded the first of the dual degree programs here with the LSE. And I'm thrilled today to be moderating a panel with some of the wonderful graduates from the program. I want to start by thanking the LSE for putting on this event and asking me to be here, for all of Thierry's work in putting this together, Vincent, of course, for running the second of the global programs, and I want to thank Nicole and Zoe and everybody who put together all of the materials for this, and I understand that Cesar, who's here somewhere, also was helping with the Facebook site, and did the logo, I believe, you know, helped with the logo. So for everyone who's contributed, we're so excited. But we could have had just a joint research set of programs with the LSE and our friends here. And we decided instead that it was going to be an actual degree program with real-life students. And so one of the things that makes this a labor of love, of course, is that the students are the centerpiece, because while Rekha did an absolutely lovely job telling us, you know, what it is that, you know, we're attempting to do, how we are trying to better scholarship as it moves forward, we do it not just for the love of knowledge, whether, you know, we do it from one perspective or another, but we do it in part because we know that we will have these amazing students to bring new ideas and to take the ideas and all of their relationships from the program and move it out into a part of the world that we don't have as great an ability to touch. And so what we're going to do is have each of them begin and tell us about themselves for 5 or so minutes. And then I've got a couple of questions to sort of get the conversation going, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. And so I ask Ariel to begin.
Thank you. I guess we should I do it sitting down or standing up? Sitting down.
Completely up to you.
I'll take the liberty of sitting down then. Flew all the way from Shanghai, so chasing good weather. It's always wonderful to be back in gloomy London, especially coming from Beijing and Shanghai. But the air here is wonderful. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you so much, Terry, for not only initiating this program, but bringing us together and being an inspiration, even in a small speech after or while coping with pneumonia. And to Dr. Riley, with whom I had the pleasure of having one short interview in 2010 at our office, so I did enjoy a one-on-one class, I would say.
And dinner in Shanghai.
Yes, and dinner in Shanghai. And to Dr. Binchung Mang, who heads the program with Fudan University, and only if you've been there, you know how difficult of a job that is. And to Dr. Shani Orgad, who inspires me in her work and diligence and perspective on our small country, Israel, which is an interesting case study for no matter what you do in life. I've been living in Shanghai since I graduated from the program in 2010. I completely fell in love with that city and all the impossible and the possible that it confronts you with on a daily basis. I run a digital agency there that I started 6 years ago. It focuses on video marketing. And it was very interesting to hear Dr. Schoen before speaking of the body of work, the physical body of ourselves and the body of work that the physical body can produce. And I think a program like this took me as a white male, a Jewish white male in my case, from Israel, from an intellectual family in Israel, brought me here, first of all, to understand that manners count and that discourse and criticism don't have to be cynical, but it always adds some spice to it. And then from here, from this wonderful intellectual campus, allowed me to explore and put my physical body in Shanghai, in China, for a whole year that made me realize that I want to stay there. The reason why I'm saying all of this is because I don't, on an everyday basis, indulge in the writings of Hall or Giddens or a Padurai nowadays. I deal with clients. But on the other hand, I do. And I don't every day enjoy discussions with Terhi and Bing Chung and Shani. But on the other hand, I do, in my own mind, because this program has made me who I am today. It's taken me from a very different background and put me where I am today. And I couldn't be happier about what I'm doing right now. I work with a wide range of clients in government, NGOs, commercial clients. I live in Shanghai, after all. And I think the body of work that I and the company that I'm proud to have started produce is a result of a physical body and a mind that has gone to these three unique places, where I was born and bred in Israel, I guess where I grew up a little bit in New York, and then London and Shanghai. And I feel that very positive and very rich baggage that I carry to every meeting, and I feel that our clients feel it as well. So for that, I'm very, very grateful. And I hope that answered a little bit of who I am and why I'm here today. So thank you.
Ellen Barrault?
Yes. So, hi everyone. I'm Ellen. I'm French, but I didn't have to travel to come see you and meet you here today because I work just around the corner at the Google UK office, which I joined 5 years ago after 2 years in Los Angeles. So right after USC, after I graduated, I knocked on the only door that I knew in Los Angeles, which was a Publicis agency, as Publicis is a French group. And they took me. I started an internship there. It was a public affairs agency, and we worked for clients in the energy sector. We did corporate communications consulting for them. So I did that for 2 years and got to travel everywhere from Alaska all the way to Africa, where I worked on a gas development pipeline. So that was pretty random, but really, really interesting and exciting. And then I decided it was time to move back to France. So I started, you know, I went online and looked for jobs. And, you know, I typed public affairs jobs on google.com and a link came up, and I sent my CV to jobs@google.com, and 5.5 years later, I'm still there, still growing, taking on new challenges every day. So today I look after B2B communications at Google for the EMEA region, So that's Europe, Middle East, and Africa. And what B2B means at Google is everything that relates to our business solutions and operations, so the way Google actually makes money. So that's both our advertising business and our cloud technology services and platforms. And thinking about what Ariel just said, I don't have much time to read beyond, you know, reading the news several times a day. But I do think about the questions that were mentioned earlier today. And actually, on the train the other day, knowing that I was coming here, I found one of the essays that I wrote when I was here in London studying at the LSE, and one of them was about whether the new media could revive Habermas's public sphere. I don't know what I'm talking about. And whether it could revive citizenry and civic participation and all of that. And believe it or not, that's a question that we ask ourselves every day at Google, being a global platform, Google and YouTube being the same company, you know, finding that balance between being an enabler for freedom of expression, for civic participation, while also finding ways to not empower hatred speech and violence, which is an issue that's that we've been debating and thinking about a lot. And I haven't met my partner, our husband, in the program, but I've met amazing friends, and one of them is here today, Zaina, and she also works with me at Google, where she actually heads up YouTube PR. So if you have any moment after this session, she has fantastic things to say about those very critical questions.
So, hi everyone, Joanna Zhang. I graduated from the program in 2005, and then I think I'm kind of like early, kind of the group. And then so my career track actually stayed more like in the business side. So after graduation, I've been always like working in Southern California. So actually I came here today with my husband from Southern California, kind of remind me about gloomy weather like in London, which I still love it. So after graduation, I actually work in the financial side. I work with a capital investment firm like in Los Angeles for a couple of years. And then I moved to PwC on the global consulting side, the US-China cross-border investments.
PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Yeah, PricewaterhouseCoopers, yeah. And then now I'm the executive director for a non-profit organization in Southern California, which is helping Chinese companies investing and doing business here, there. So I think my career path, I will say, I really appreciate I be part of this program, and I'm very grateful. Like, I had the opportunity to grow with the program and also meet a lot of friends and, you know, professors. And I benefited a lot from different parts. I think, like, the skill sets, actually, I think, you know, I acquired through the program definitely helped me a lot in my career. For instance, like, the skill set, right? Like, you know, the technical skills. When I walk on the campus today, like, earlier today, I saw some buildings, like, you know, Peacock Theater, which immediately remind me about the course I was taking at LSE, like statistics, which actually gave me a lot of, you know, headache at that time. But unbelievably, after I started my work with the financial side, I was so impressive to my team, because they say, "We thought you're a communication major. We didn't know, like, you know SPSS so well." Like, even better than MBA students. So I think that is, like, a very interesting part. And then the other thing, actually, I think I benefit a lot is, you know, this program and also the platform provide me, you know, like, opportunities really to understand and learn the different cultures, which is, like, so important for the global firm. Because when you're working for a global firm like Google or PwC or other, like, you know, consulting firms, once you're on the cross-border projects, you will find that you just work with people from all different parts of the world, right? You really need to understand each other and build, you know, kind of mutual understanding. and which will have great impact on how smooth the project can be moved forward. And then, so I think, you know, for that part, really made who I am today. And right now, in my new role, my interest is always, how China and Chinese companies can be globalized in a globalizing world. So I'm very grateful, this program provide me the foundation knowledge about globalization, all different perspectives. And now I'm just helping the Chinese companies to tell the story, say why they are investing, in different parts of the world, whether they want to be integrated with the local communities, and what kind of contribution, rather than making profits, they can, make an impact. So which is a very, kind of a challenging, still challenging, but a new, journey for me. So hopefully, if you have any interest, we can, talk more later as well. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, my name is Jonas. I'm originally from Berlin, where I'm living right now, just here for the weekend as well. And first of all, let me say it's amazing. I had no idea that there were so many of us, especially here in the room, but I think also someone mentioned the number of 600 alumni just from the program. I think that's amazing and spectacular. And just also meeting you guys so far, it's been a great pleasure. So I graduated in 2009-2011, so did the 2009-2011 cohort, and went to Fudan. And it was really interesting, though I must say I sort of really got in here while I was at LSE. So basically after graduating, I decided to come back, and I started working the next 2 years for LSE Cities, which is an urban research center here on campus. And basically during why I did that was also that during my time at LSE, I audited loads of classes, and I don't know, maybe some of you also did the same. But I think that was one of the greatest things, to be able to be exposed every day. Someone, I think, mentioned it also in the video. Every day wake up and think wow, you have a completely new understanding of the world. And so I got really interested in cities as sort of maybe also the analytical unit, maybe if you think about de-Westernizing, maybe we also, it's worthwhile to think of sort of global cities as such as a frame of reference, and how they are acting collectively. And this is sort of what intrigued me, and I stayed with that. So I went to the research center, and then after 2 years, I decided to do a training program with the European Commission. So I moved to Brussels, and following that, I moved back to Berlin to get married, actually, with my wife, who I met on the program as well. So I know that we were not the first, but we are maybe the second. But she's unfortunately couldn't be here today. She sends her regards as well. And anyway, so now we are settled in Berlin, two globals. I'm working now on two different projects. One is with the International Relations Department of the City of Berlin, where we are building up a platform for cities all over the world to learn from each other and sort of exchange good practices, for experts to connect with each other. And so I could really relate also again to what Professor Calhoun mentioned at the beginning, that a lot of the work I'm doing now is really about creating those connections. And I realized that's what I enjoy a lot, and also what I learned a lot at LSE. So while I was at LSE Cities, I organized most of their events, and obviously you always have to interact with high-level people, and I think that's one of the things maybe you take from this program is you learn to lose a bit of the respect for authority, but in a good way. So you are not, you're not taking those big theorists too serious. I think also our professors in the department always challenged us, to not take it too serious, but also just the high caliber of people you meet here really forms you and sort of gives you sort of a yes, I could do anything once I graduate from this program. And I think that's a very good spirit to take from it. And then So this was the one project I'm working on right now. And then the second project is I'm working with the university, the Technical University in Berlin, and we are sort of dealing with new participatory planning methods and using new technologies, new media, to also see, look, we now have all the technology to communicate much more comprehensively and easily to the general public how our cities will transform in the future. So we are very much trying to change the culture also in Berlin on the topic of smart cities. Every city wants to become a smart city nowadays. So I'm working on that sort of in Berlin. So yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. This is a very interesting. I remember back at school, you know, when you finished your class, the professors first time told you what's the reading list, the books on the list. You would rush to the library to find the books. I'm always, always second in the queue for the last copy. And so I realized I'm in the same situation because all these guys have told the cool stories. Now I've got not much to say. But anyway, I try my best. So my name is Vivian, and I graduated from LSE in 2008. So originally I was from China, and because of school I moved here, and after graduation I worked here. One of the things I think I really benefit from studying in LSE is this is one of the truly, truly international school, and we do the global program as well. My classmates all come from different countries, different continents, have different culture and working experiences. And then again, our professors as well. We've got professors from the US, from Finland, from Italy, from Greek, all the different places. And the course structure really taught me different areas within the mass media and communications, and also other optional courses, you benefit from cross-subject different courses within the